Welcome. I'm very excited to be here today to talk about one of the Fourth Plan's most ambitious and really one of its most difficult proposals, which is changing the way our transit agencies are governed. My name is Juliette Michelson. I'm Executive Vice President at RPA and in charge of the development of the Fourth Regional Plan with RIT and everybody on staff's help. So you heard from Tom this morning that the region can and should continue to grow over the next 25 years, but that this growth can take place only if it is supported by a really terrific transportation infrastructure in general, really. And what we have here today is simply not going to cut it. We need to upgrade the systems we have. We need to expand the systems we have. We need rail. We need better buses. We need other ways to get around as well. We need a comprehensive, cost-effective, integrated, customer-oriented transportation network. And so the question is, how are we going to get there? Is it just more money that the transit agencies need, or is it real reform? The findings of the survey this morning were really illuminating. For those of you who were not there, we asked people, in order to build the next generation of transportation projects, what do the agencies need? 1% of the respondents said that they needed nothing. Everything was going swimmingly. Thank you very much. We'll be able to deliver them all on time and on budget. 5% thought that more funding would do the trick. 38% said that in addition to funding, the agencies also needed to be better managed. And a whopping 56% said that in addition to funding, the agencies needed meaningful reform. And that's what we're here to talk about today. We have an all-star panel here today. We have Rit Agarwal, Veronica Vanderpool, Jay Walder, Greg Clark. I will give them more of an introduction in a minute. But before we begin, I wanted to give you a little bit set the stage for the conversation we're going to be having this morning. Transit use is at an all-time high. Trains are crowded. Buses are slow and unreliable. Only one new station has been added to the subway network in the last several decades. Second Avenue will add 3 more. The MTA capital plan failed to fund a new signaling system that would have been given us the ability to run trains much closer together and increase capacity that way. Penn Station and the Port Authority continue to be the bane of the existence of hundreds of thousands of people every day. And this 100-year-old Sandy-ravaged tunnel is the only way to get in from the Northeast Corridor, get into Manhattan. We need a transportation system to support a competitive economy, improve job access and economic opportunity, and reduce carbon emissions. That is the first problem that we need to address. The second is that our transit system really is very poorly coordinated. Tracks run straight through Penn Station, and yet Long Island Railroad and New Jersey Transit can't manage to find a way to run trains from Long Island to New Jersey. We have, at various times in the past, talked about extending the subway into New Jersey or connecting the PATH system into the subway network. Those conversations really don't go very far because the politics seems so insurmountable. A third problem is that other cities around the world focus on customer service to an extent that we can barely imagine here. Here the focus is on moving trains. There the focus is truly on providing a seamless travel experience from end to end. We are light years behind on that front. Capital expansion projects, Second Avenue, East Side Access, Fulton Street, many others, are behind schedule and over budget. I'll spare you the details. You've heard them all before, I'm sure. And that really gives people pause when thinking about the next generation of projects. Even the most committed transit advocates do have to wonder how much Gateway will cost or when it will be able to be delivered. But really, the most fundamental challenge we have today is that our public authorities, which were originally designed with their independent boards of directors to be isolated from day-to-day politics, truly are not. They've effectively become state agencies run by the governors, and that means they're no longer able to identify, fund, build long-term, complicated, expensive projects that the region needs. And this political meddling, by the way, is made easier by the fact that the role of the private sector is very limited in the management and the financing of these authorities. We need more political accountability, and we need more market accountability. And when you think about it that way, maybe it isn't that surprising that our operating costs and our construction costs are some of the highest in the world. So those are the challenges that we're trying to address here. And what we're going to do is flip these challenges and turn them into guiding principles. And with you and with this panel here today, we're going to talk about five different potential solutions, approaches to change the way that our transit agencies are run, and evaluate them against these five guiding principles. Okay, so this is kind of like our scorecards. Are we making the right investment decisions? Are we promoting projects that support economic development, equity, environmental goals? Are we providing a seamless transit experience, accelerating the adoption of ideas, becoming more cost-effective, and providing more accountability? Okay, option number one. Raise new sources of money. If we want to raise more money, we know how to do it. We can increase the gas tax, toll the bridges. Now that the technology is here, we could charge drivers a per-mile fee based on the current level of traffic. We've got lots of options. We could do these things. We could do these things, and they will raise enough money to be able to build more investment, but they really wouldn't address the other problems that we have, not necessarily. Option number two, we have talked about reforming the boards of these authorities to make them more accountable, to make them more transparent. We've talked about changing the compositions of the boards or changing the way meetings are held, changing the way decisions are approved. But the truth is, like we were saying before, that the biggest problem is what happens when the governors choose CEOs or board members who are simply there to do their bidding, to call the shots before the boards even meet. If board members don't have the freedom, the power, or the knowledge to vote independently, then is there a board at all? And really, it isn't clear what can be done about that. So let's say if we were to enact some ambitious board reforms, we might be able to better coordinate between different transit agencies, and we might be able to reduce some political interference. But our success, I think, would be limited. The third option that we have been thinking about is to create sort of a super agency, a regional transportation agency. Look at that, we've even branded it. One of the problems today is that there really are a lot of cooks in the kitchen. There is not one agency in charge of the regional transportation system. And so with this, presumably you would get better coordination between the services. Although, considering the MTA's track record in bringing Long Island Railroad and Metro North together, maybe, maybe not, but let's give it to them so that they would be able to better coordinate services. But the truth is that a consolidation might also create new bureaucracy and increase costs. And not clear that the political interference would go away either. Option number four. In this scenario, we're creating a central body responsible for planning and financing the transit system across the tri-state area, and then contracting out the operations. So in this case, the public keeps ownership of the assets, the train, the tracks, the buses, the infrastructure, and is responsible for making capital investment. They also set the fares and set the service level requirements. But the authority would put out to bid contracts to drive the buses, conduct the trains, clean the stations. So this is different from what we have now in two ways, just to be clear. First of all, we're talking about one agency in charge of the across the region, so it's clear who is responsible and accountable for integration between the services. And for each of the major operating functions, what we're doing is signing concession agreements with potentially private companies up for renewal every 5 to 10 years, okay? Now, of course, setting and then monitoring and enforcing performance targets, rewarding with financial incentives, good service provision, et cetera, would be really important in this model. But that model does seem to be working well in London with the overground and Stockholm with its metro. In this model, although the financing and planning authority remains a public sector agency, it is governed it would be structured to attract private sector investment and then reserve some spots on its board to some of those investors. And that would be a way to infuse some market accountability in decision making. The way that this agency, this authority, would make large capital investments would be to create special purpose entities for individual capital investments. And in each of these, a business case would have to be made that is worth doing. So the public sector representatives on the board would make sure that the project furthered the public service element of the project, and the private sector representatives would help shape the project to maximize return on investment. So let's evaluate this, this structure. So really it would help on all fronts, we believe. By increasing access to capital, it would promote investment, increase quality of service, accelerate innovation, but by keeping an eye on ROI, it would also help reduce costs, reduce political interference. The main difficulty with this model, I think, is going to be to avoid a gap between the planning and the operations of the system. It's very easy to imagine disputes between the public authority and the private operators over who is responsible for what. And if these private operators have, let's say, 5 to 10 year contracts, it's also easy to imagine that long-term investments are maybe not going to be at the top of their priority list. So maybe things are not quite as simple. Maybe there are problems here with long-term investment in this structure. The way to really get the private sector to invest in the long term would be to, and this is the final model, would be to give them a long-term right to manage and operate the transit system. The thing is, if a company is in charge of everything from maintaining the assets to setting the fares, deciding the service levels, deciding which capital investments need to be pursued, then that power really needs to be balanced with strong public representation to make sure that transit continues to be a public service. This is Hong Kong. Jay will tell us more about it. There, it is a private company that runs the system, but MTR is a publicly traded private company. And so the government is the majority shareholder. Oops. Okay, thank you. So the public sector still has quite a bit of say over the policy. Thank you, policy decision making and capital investment. But investments do need to be justified economically, right? Either through fare box recovery or through land use deals or simply through government grants to the project. So although I do think this option would help us meet all of our goals, it might add a new challenge, and that would be to keep the public in public transportation. Obviously, this is the hardest scenario to imagine here, for political reasons, I mean. But it certainly is worth considering for the purposes of today's conversation, because first of all, this morning inspired us to think big and think beyond some of the solutions that have been discussed. And also because it really works very successfully in Hong Kong, Tokyo, and other places. And by the way, one last admonition before I transfer it over. All of these scenarios, whether we're talking about a public sector entity with private sector representation or a private sector entity with public sector representation on it, all of them require smart and savvy public servants who can make the right planning and financing decisions, who can both protect and promote the public benefit of transportation, and who can negotiate in a savvy way with the private sector and not get sort of swallowed up. So, with all of that in mind, I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to introduce our terrific panelists and get their take on all of these models and maybe make some headway in the conversation in New York. So let me first introduce Veronica Vanderpool. Veronica is a very good friend. In addition to being a very good friend, she is also the executive director of the Tri-State Transportation Campaign and happens to be one of the people who Mayor de Blasio nominated to the MTA board last year, but whose confirmation seems to be mysteriously stalled. I don't want to dwell too much on the problems, but over the years, you have seen, this panel is really supposed to be about solution, but I really can't resist asking Veronica to tell us a little bit about some of the most egregious examples of that you've seen of government interfering with sound planning.
Thank you, Juliette. Good morning, everyone. I represent the advocacy community, and we know that this conversation about governance is really about accountability and efficiency. And there's seven quick examples that I could list. Many of you are familiar with these examples. They've dominated the headlines for more than a year of the problems of our governance structure as it exists today. So, Bridgegate. I need not go into that any further. We're all well-versed on the complications of Bridgegate. But Bridgegate precipitated a reform movement. Finally, it turned the collective public eye toward the Port Authority, an eye that has neglected the Port Authority and, in fact, let a lot of decisions be made and decisions run rampant without a lot of oversight. While the public has put a great deal of oversight into agencies like the MTA. And because of Bridgegate, there has been a reform movement that has endured two legislative sessions, and still the governance structure is still broken for Port Authority, that there have been two legislative sessions, two pieces of legislation, four chambers in two states, that has not yet been signed into law by either governor, either executive of New York or New Jersey. That is a clear breakdown in governance. There is a clear mandate from the public that says, we want these reforms. Our legislatures in two states, that is no easy feat, have passed these bills, and the governors have not yet signed it. But in fact, they put forth their own reform, their own report, and said, we know what to do to reform the Port Authority. And in fact, they released that on the eve of Thanksgiving. And those of us who were paying attention to this and expecting it to drop saw some unusual things, and that such as, let's reduce path service and just run it during the weekdays. Let's cut overnight and weekend service. So again, that's just one example of when executive decisions are made, and they're not being made with an eye to the public. We see examples of waste and corruption and unaccountability and opaqueness. We, the MTA, another example of legislative reform gone astray. For two sessions, the legislature of New York State passed lockbox reform. Basically, this legislation said, we want to ensure that before the state legislature uses dedicated transit funds for any other purpose other than transit, for example, siphoning it and putting it into the general fund, we would like the legislature to create an impact diversion statement. And this legislation passed in 2011, and then it passed unanimously in 2013. and Governor Cuomo vetoed the 2013 legislation. He did sign the 2011 with some caveats that essentially stripped that impact diversion statement. Basically, another disregard for the public mandate. No easy feat for the chambers of New York State government to agree on legislation in two sessions, and the governor did not sign this legislation. Another example, the ARC tunnel. One executive alone controlled the decision for ARC. Shovels were already in the ground. Planning was underway for 20 years. The federal government, it was one of the largest transit projects, the largest transit project at that time in the country. Governor Christie canceled it based on some flawed reasoning that, in fact, the independent, nonpartisan GAO said the governor's rationale was not correct. In New Jersey, the Transportation Trust Fund, a clear problem in New Jersey. New Jersey right now, 100% of all of its revenue is going toward debt service. And this has been an impending problem for years. People have forecast this problem for at least 6-7 years. And the legislature has still not come up with a solution. They are very timid about passing new revenue sources, such as the gas tax. Yet, bridges are crumbling, road pavement is in awful repair, NJ Transit continues to raise fares, and the legislature will not pass any sort of new revenue. And there's an interesting political dynamic, of course, with the executive, Governor Christie, who says, well, the legislature's not putting anything forth, I'm not going to sign anything. And, of course, the legislature says, well, we're not going to put anything forth because the governor's not going to sign anything. And we're stuck. We also have, just coming back to the MTA, right now New York City is at a disadvantage. They don't have their full voting power on the MTA board. They just have essentially 25 or 50% of their voting power. And the nominations that have been put forth by Mayor de Blasio last year, as Juliet said, are still in limbo. So New York City is really at a minority on this board, has been, but even more so by not having their full slate of candidates. And there's no clear reason, it's not a procedural, substantive reason why these nominees have not yet been confirmed by the state Senate. It's a political discussion and a political holdup. And then lastly, you know, this is a little bit of a wild card maybe, but it's a topic or conversation that's simmered a bit. So the MTA serves Connecticut and also works very closely with Port Authority in New Jersey, but yet there's no Connecticut nor New Jersey representative on the MTA board. Now, there's a legitimate reason for that. The MTA is a state, New York State authority, but there are non-voting members on the MTA board. Maybe there's some thought given to other members of our region who should be part of this governance structure. So all of these examples just speak to the fact that we have a broken governance structure that has resulted in significant projects being canceled, political holds up, not full voices being heard, and we from the advocacy community are very excited to think about how we can sort of bust through this mold. This is not working, and entertain further with you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Rit. A call to action, if I've ever heard one. Rit Agarwal here, he's been introduced already today, but he is the chair of the 4th Regional Plan, and in his spare time, he is also the chief policy officer at Sidewalk Labs. Before that, he was a long-term advisor to Mayor Bloomberg and the force behind Plan YC. I was going to ask you about the article that you wrote a couple of years ago, and we'll get to that, but frankly, following Veronica's passionate argument here, I guess I'd like you to describe to us what is the specific role that this particular recommendation plays in the 4th plan in your mind? In other words, what is sort of the moment of the tipping point for change that you see here?
Well, I think over the last 3 years that we've been working on the 4th plan, I think it has become crystal clear that the list of challenges that Veronica just outlined are not just, as we saw through the voting this morning, it's not just about getting more money. And it isn't just about the specific individuals involved today, right? And I think, you know, the list you identified, of course, largely under the governorships of Mr. Cuomo and Mr. Christie, and whatever we may individually think about them, whatever we may individually think about the current board members, the current managers, the current staff of the several agencies, I think we come to the inescapable conclusion that you could put gods and angels and you could flood the place with money, and you still will not actually solve these problems. So I think fundamentally, the fourth regional plan has to give a very strong vote of no confidence in the fundamental structure of all of our regional agencies. I mean, it is deeply profound that the current system cannot be put back together again. We are going to have to think deeply about how we change things. And what's been really interesting as well, and Greg and Jay, with all of your global experience, I'm looking forward to your thoughts. Of course, we've talked with you all before. The age of the agencies that govern transit and infrastructure in the New York City area is older than any of our peers around the world. Right? You look at the kind of organizational reform that has gone on over the last 30 years in the major cities of Europe and Asia, and they have all transformed their structures in ways that we can barely, you know, we can't even appoint board members. Right? And I think that indicates that if we tend to, as Americans, so often we travel abroad and we say, oh, you know, the trains work much better here and they've got the Oyster card and they've got the octopus and all of these great things, why don't we have them? And then we come back and say, well, it's about more money and they have higher taxes. It's not just about that. Right? And it's not just about finding the new equipment or whatever. It is fundamentally rethinking how the incentives for decision-making are aligned. Right? And so I think that is what we have to wrestle with. And the points that you had above in terms of getting the right priorities and rewarding performance, I mean, kind of on this panel this morning, it was part of the clear message, this conundrum of growth not creating benefits that people can see. And of course, in any business, particularly due to the fundamentals of how you calculate depreciation, right, and how you price things, growing revenue, growing customers, leads almost inevitably, not 100%, but it usually leads to direct reinvestment, right, to expand capacity. And that's what we do not have. Right? And so what we've seen is the subways get more and more crowded. That has no relationship to the amount of money that's being reinvested in the system. More and more people rely on the path. That does not mean that we have more money directed to the path. So somehow we have to get these incentives aligned. And the trick, of course, is that we can look around both the United States and around the world and find, unfortunately, as many counterexamples as positive examples. We can say, yes, we should create a more regional structure. We look 200 miles to the south in Washington, and of course, it's not crystal clear that a three-jurisdiction governing board actually necessarily leads to a better functioning subway system, as the Washington Metro directly demonstrates, right? So we also have to be really cognizant about getting this right. But I think introducing the private sector somehow in a much more forceful role, finding ways to go back, the origins of all of these authorities, at the time that they were created, they were state of the art in terms of how you set up institutions to be honest, to be independent, to be transparent. But think about the Port Authority, which is as old as the Regional Plan Association, is older than the Securities and Exchange Commission. So today we think of corporate governance as being reasonably transparent because there are a lot of laws that protect institutional shareholders. There are no such laws that seem to work right now to protect the citizens of New York or New Jersey from the actions of the MTA board or the Port Authority board. Right? Now, the equivalent in terms of corporate governance did not exist when the Port Authority was created, so that was not a viable model. Today, and what Europe has identified through corporatization, which a number of things, and we don't have to think about corporatization and privatization as the same thing. A lot of jurisdictions around the world, particularly for infrastructure, have used a corporate form even while maintaining governmental and political control. Right? But that is, I think, one of the things we have to think about. What are the well-functioning organizational structures that we see around us outside of the transit industry today? How can we bring them into bear just as 90-some-odd years ago they thought about how do you bring the best thinking around governance to bear on the Port Authority then? But what was state-of-the-art when it was created is clearly, clearly obsolete today.
So I'd like to ask Greg Clark, who has held several leadership positions on transportation and urban development projects in London and who now advises cities around the world on these leadership questions, to talk a little bit about the vote of no confidence moment that London had several years ago before it decided to reform the way that London invested in its transportation system and decided, changed the way decisions were made. Would you describe to us how that happened?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for the invitation. So in 1991, if you'd asked the people of London what are the things that they're most worried about, they would have said competition from New York, Tokyo, Paris, and a few other places. They would have said public transportation, and they would have said schools. And if you ask the people in 2016 in London what they're most concerned about, they'll say housing, they'll say air quality, and they'll say aviation. They will not say transportation. They will not say competition from New York, although that's a kind of permanent agenda. And they will not say schools, because London has been through the most radical reform process in our education systems and our transport systems that you could imagine. Just a quick list to make this key. In 91, the anxiety in London was the highest it had been since the Second World War, because the feeling was that London didn't have a story about its future, and New York had clearly won the 20th century as the emerging city of that century. London had felt it was waning. And the kickstart in 1991 led to the opening of what we call High Speed 1, the Eurostar, the high-speed rail from London to Paris and Brussels. It led to the creation and extension of the Jubilee Line, a new underground system, the creation and financing of the Docklands Light Railway, a corporate model in the way that's just been described, the creation of the Heathrow Express Line, which links the airport high speed into central London, the design, development and build of the East London Line, a new line that connects them, the integration and corporatization and management of the London Overground, the creation of the Crossrail 1 high-speed regional rail project about to open, the creation of the Crossrail 2 high-speed regional rail project about to break ground, and the extension or modernization of all of the London Underground lines, and a massive investment in the improvement of the service experience. So the Oyster card, ticketless travel, the congestion charging system, and many other things I don't have time to list. And the reason I list all of this is because nobody in London would have thought any of that was possible, to do all of those things in a 25-year period, and to move us to the point where Londoners complain about the transportation still, because that's a cultural characteristic of Londoners, yeah? We like to complain about transport, like we like to talk about the weather, yeah? But our transport system is now seen as at least medium to good, and it's certainly consistently ranked as better than New York's. And I think that's the point I want to make today. So in order to encourage you, yeah? How did that happen? Well, it happened through a combination of different things, and Jay is very familiar with these things, so he'll give you his own insights about that. But I think three things have been very important in London. Number one, we figured out that you have to get serious about big projects, and we adopted essentially the model that Rit just described, which is to use the skills and acumen and corporate governance style of business, but to use them with a public purpose objective around the biggest projects. So whether it's High Speed 2 that we're now building, or High Speed 3 that we're planning to build, or Crossrail 1 or Crossrail 2, all of these big projects are essentially managed by public interest companies in which the major shareholders are the governmental entities. And the idea is to use the transparency, the performance drive, the clarity of purpose of business entities to deliver public goods projects. That's the kind of first piece. The second piece, of course, is that we have reformed our governance, and we've created a model that you will find very familiar, which is a directly elected regional mayor, where the design of it was to give the mayor the executive power of the mayor of New York, combined with the regional purview of the regional government of Paris. And that was the design idea in our system. And within this Greater London Authority, the Transport for London Authority was integrated and created. Jay used to be a very senior manager there. And that Transport for London Authority has essentially led a process of expansion, reform, and improvement, which overall has garnered the trust, not just of the citizens, which is very important, but garnered the trust of the national government. Now, at the heart of this, I would say it's very important to understand this is the third element, that there's been a kind of new consensus or new narrative about transportation and regional success. And the narrative goes something like this. If the UK is to succeed, London must succeed. If London succeeds, it's going to grow. If it's going to grow, we have to invest in the ability to accommodate growth. That essentially means investing in transportation as the key means to shape, manage, and create the potential for growth. If London's going to do that, it can't do that at the expense of the rest of the country. So we have to find ways for London to grow and to pay its own way in transportation terms, but at the same time to make a contribution to national coffers. Therefore, we have to innovate with how we finance all of these schemes. In order to do that, we have to create a system that everybody feels is credible because we'll be looking for finance from multiple sources. So just quickly now, Juliet, to finish up. So what does this mean? We have this Greater London Authority with this Transport for London body. The Mayor of London is the Chairman of Transport for London. Transport for London is a corporate body within the public sector, a public interest company, 12 board members, 5 of them are women, 7 of them are men. One of them is a celebrated Paralympic athlete. They come from broad backgrounds, but they include lawyers, engineers, bankers, people with huge expertise. The chief executive of British Airways is on the board for the Board of Transport for London. So these are not boards of cronies. These are people appointed for their abilities. And we have a set of rules. Yeah, we have a set of rules in the UK about how a politician can and cannot appoint people to boards like this. And you have to essentially appoint the best people for the job at hand. Transport for London includes within it a mixed market of activities. So in terms of surface transport, things like buses and roads and taxis, it uses private sector concessions. This was one of Juliet's models. All of the buses are run through private sector concessions, even if the London transport system owns the roads. In terms of rail, there's a mix of things that are concessions, publicly owned and others. In terms of the London Overground and the Docklands Light Railway and the Heathrow Express are run as companies with a service contract, whereas the underground lines are run as operating corporate divisions within Transport for London. And then the last thing is that it runs also a series of logistics and other facilities. So the delivery mode is a mixture of private concessionaires, public interest companies, and direct delivery, depending upon which is best, to deliver the best service or to raise the amount of capital needed to do the job. So different kinds of balance sheets working together to deliver the same service. I think that's all I need to say, but I think the thing to remember is reforming the governance alongside a new approach to delivering big projects and combining that with a realization it's going to cost more money and therefore everybody has to trust it. London Transport is more expensive than New York's transport system. London invests more than New York does.
You have to spend money to make money, right? So lastly, we have Jay Walder on this panel, who is uniquely qualified to be on this panel since he has occupied very senior leadership position in London, has headed the MTA and then headed MTR in Hong Kong, and is now back in New York in a different position, and we'll get to that. But would you please describe for us maybe a compare and contrast? You can include New York or not. Frankly, I think what would be most interesting is the difference between a London model that is a primarily public sector with an infusion of private sector role compared to Hong Kong, which is sort of the flip of that.
Sure. By the way, a fantastic description, I think, of the history of the change that's taken place in London, and it was actually very special to be part of it, and it's just continued. I mean, I think one of the other, if I would just add two other points to what you said before I turn to Hong Kong, one is that it's actually continued and prospered under two different mayors from two different parties who are night and day different. And I don't know who won the election.
We don't know
yet. But that's what's happened over 16 years. And I think that by itself is a real statement about what happened. I think the second thing that, you know, we sometimes wipe away from our memory is that we didn't get everything right. Mm. And, you know, some of what you just described is actually the second or third generation of trying to do some of that. And so particularly around the PPP.
Sure.
And the public-private partnership of the London Underground, there was some learning experience that took place in that process. And I think you've seen a lot of that change take place in bus contracting. You've seen it take place in rail contracting. You've seen it take place in the PPP. So I don't think it's something in which one has to necessarily believe that you get everything right on day one. You have to believe that you set up a structure that allows you to be able to take that in and to be able to adjust. Hong Kong, by the way, I mean, and to show some of the ways that the MTR and London come together, the London Overground, which Greg mentioned, is actually run by MTR in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Crossrail, which will start its operations shortly, is run by MTR in Hong Kong. So it's, you know, the linkages there remain in doing that, and I think that's actually terrific. MTR, to turn to Hong Kong for a second, it's a model that in many ways is reverse. It is a private company. It is traded on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. It follows those rules, much as we think of, IBM or Coca-Cola following the rules of the New York Stock Exchange in doing that. When you think about change, and again, you've made the point about change, think about this change. MTR started as a public company. It did not start as a private company. It was privatized through an IPO that took place in 2000, so about 16 years ago, and it was privatized after Hong Kong became part of the People's Republic of China. So an irony there that I think probably not lost on us in thinking about that. Does it meet public interest? You know, does it mean that a private entity cannot meet public interest? Does it meet public interest? Well, one way of thinking about public interest is that 99.9% of the trains run on time in Hong Kong. That's public interest. Five new rail lines are being built right now in Hong Kong. That's public interest. So I think there are a lot of arguments about how private companies can be public interest in doing it. I don't think we should treat that as opposites in doing that. One other point I'd make about this is if you look at, you know, one of the fastest growing urban railways in the world is in Beijing. Beijing has gone from a few kilometers to, I don't know, it's 600, 800 kilometers of track now. Most of the Beijing railway is run by a public company, which is the Beijing Metro, with the exception of three rail lines, line 4, line 14, and line 16, which are actually run by MTR. And so here you have an incredibly complex railway, and the decision has been made to take part of it and put it in private hands and keep other parts of it in public hands. I think the difference there to what happened in London, and something that I would argue needs to be thought carefully about, is it's not bifurcated. MTR is responsible for building the line, it's responsible for maintaining the line, it's responsible for operating the line. So it has that total responsibility that is there. I also think that there are, there are many other models, and you mentioned this before. I mean, the Japan railways are a fantastic example of how to be able to do this, and in many ways are even more innovative about some of the things that they are doing as well. Stockholm, one of the fastest growing cities of Europe, by the way, which I wasn't aware of. Contracts out its entire metro system again to MTR. So MTR, you know, it is called Stockholm Metro. MTR is in the background, but it operates that entire metro system in being able to do that. I'll make one last and admittedly self-serving point here, But New York actually has a pretty good example of a public-private partnership that's going on in the transportation space right now. It's called Citibike. It's run by a private company. It works collaboratively and cooperatively with the Department of Transportation. It is deeply committed to customer service outcomes. And as one of the newspapers reported this morning, it had a 110% increase in utilization over the first 3 months of this year. I think it's working. And while the scale of Citibike doesn't compare to the scale of the MTA or the challenges that are out there, I think a lot of the parameters that are within that are things that we should look at and understand and think about how to be able to grow and prosper. And it's homegrown, so it's sitting in front of us.
So I feel like the narrative here in New York, and really, frankly, in the U.S. in general, is that PPP means handing over the keys to the private sector. And I guess I'd like to ask, really, any of you, actually, if you've all different experiences on this issue, but how do we change? I mean, is it through an example like Citibike? Is it through a different model? How do we change that perception? How do we make sure that people understand that there can actually be, it isn't just a question of bringing in the money because we can't raise the taxes and therefore we need the public sector and gosh, we're going to have to give them something in exchange. That it is actually, there is a real benefit to having investors look over the shoulder of government and shape projects to provide some market accountability in addition to political accountability. Does anyone want to take this on?
I would say that we're not ready yet in the public space to think about PPPs. And the reason I'll say that is because we need to look in the short term, 3 to 5 to 7 years, about what we're going to do to fix the governance model now. So the mandate of the fourth regional plan is long term. And they're thinking, and we are helping them think, about the best, most efficient governance model in decades to come. But right now, there's some real key issues that we need to address to instill and restore the public's confidence in our agencies. And I think before we can do that, before we can start exploring a P3 model, we need to strengthen the existing governance structures that we have now. So One radical idea is remove the executive from the decision-making, from the appointment process. Every single authority in this region has board members appointed by the executives of that state. Have fixed terms. Right now, a lot of the board members serve at the pleasure of, and that creates significant problems. These are things that erode the public's confidence in decision-making and in project delivery and project timetables. So I think that we really need to think a little bit more short-term before we can start thinking about P3s. And it's an approach that we support. We think that it has to be part of the new discussions when we're thinking about transportation infrastructure. In this region alone, there's $400 billion of transportation unmet need. There have to be new models, and P3 has to be part of that conversation. But I just think that we have a gap to fill and address right now before we can really convince the public that P3s are the way to go.
I see Rit frowning.
Yeah, I guess I disagree with you, Veronica, because I think there's no time like the present. And at the end of the day, we can rearrange the deck chairs on this sinking ship, but the ship's sinking, right? I mean, God knows, none of us is going to live long enough under the current setup to ride the Second Avenue subway into the Bronx, and we'll be lucky if our kids do, right? And in terms of how you change the narrative, I mean, honestly, could it get much worse? I mean, really? Like, how terrible does a public-private partnership have to be before it's actually producing worse outcomes than the fact that here we are 25 years after the ARC work started, and we're talking about, yeah, hopefully we'll get started on building a tunnel under the Hudson, right? And I think if you think about the alternative scenario in which that had been set up as a public-private partnership, you know, I mean, you laid it at the feet of Governor Christie, and of course he was the guy who pulled the trigger at the end of the day, and I think it was a terrible decision on his part. But we can't forget that fundamentally the fact that the MTA, New Jersey Transit, and the Port Authority could not come up with a joint proposal was actually the root cause of ARC's failure, right? And so this is not just about the current governors. It's not just about the current leadership. It's not even, and of course, we are all friends with many of the people and have a lot of respect, and many of us are alumni of some of these agencies and entities. It's not the individuals. This is a structure that is broken, and the sooner we start facing that fact and come up with new alternatives, the sooner we are to begin to catch up to London. And I think Greg's point is right. You know, in addition to London feeling more insecure and worrying about New York in 1995, I mean, it's a city that never would have had a strategic plan then that said, brazenly, the greatest city on earth. Mm. London is a bigger city than New York is today. Right? It is bigger. It has gained a much greater share of its population over the last 25 years. Mm. And arguably, it's a much better place to live today. And I say that with great sadness.
Yeah. It's not about the individuals. It's about the self-interested position that's available. So, again, coming back to the boards, they serve at the pleasure. So if you have fixed terms, you're removing some of that incentive and initiative to be renominated to that position. So I think 5-10 years from now, there could be different people in the roles, and they still have the same problems. I think it's the position and the structure of the position that creates the self-interested decision-making.
So, Greg, if you were to give us advice... Sorry, Jay.
That's okay. Take it.
What would be the wedge, the crack in the door that you would use for us to start changing the dialogue?
The thing that made the biggest difference in London was Londoners seeing big, successful projects being implemented. Seeing High Speed 1, the ability to get to Paris in 2.25 hours, the ability to get to Brussels in 1.75 hours, the ability to get on the Heathrow Express to be from central London to Heathrow Airport in 15 minutes. In the end, the thing that changed the mind of Londoners was seeing delivery. Nobody worried that HS1 was a PPP and Heathrow Express was a private company. It's there. It's working. So I think the value of demonstration projects, not instead of the reforms,
that are being talked about, but as a way to motivate the reforms was very important in our context. Those things came first. Then we did the reforms, and Jay was right with all of his comments about the increments of change that went here. And then people said, okay, well, if TfL, Transport for London, could do things as good as Eurostar or Heathrow Express, why wouldn't we want them to? And that, I think, then led to this huge renewal of public trust, renewal of confidence in these bodies, fixed terms, publicly scrutable, you know, appointments, transparency at every level on who's on the board and who makes decisions, and, of course, consolidation of power into one entity with public interest, not this problem that you seem to be describing that I don't understand very well, of multiple entities, even to the point where our national government is now devolving the management of the suburban rail services to Transport for London, because everybody can see one entity that works really well with this mixed market of delivery mechanisms of concessions and public interest companies and PPPs, that's the best thing. So give it everything to do, then you get an integrated transport system.
Sounds easy.
I thought it was just going to comment on the management at the beginning is what really made it work.
Yeah.
No.
Well, there were some brilliant managers.
But I think I would add one other piece. I don't think it was just big projects. So, I mean, I think for TfL, I think that congestion pricing was, of course, huge in showing that and making that happen. But I actually think that the work about the streets and the bus system and that also went a very long way to establishing early day credibility about what happens. The big projects take a long time. And I think what people actually began to see was, and you mentioned even in a much simpler way, our buses are stuck in traffic and we were struggling with it, people began to see change take place actually pretty quickly after TfL started in a way that built some momentum in being able to do that. But I would come back to Rit's point. I think that the change is more fundamental. I think Greg has laid out an absolutely stellar description of a path that took place in the UK. Is it, you know, can you lift it off and bring it here? Of course not. But it's a stellar description of that and what happened over that period of time. By the time I went there, it literally was 10 years after that path had started to be able to do that. I think we have to challenge ourselves. I think we have to be guided by international models. I think we have to challenge ourselves to be able to do this. I think we must figure out how to get private participation in what we're doing, not around the edges, but in a really, really fundamental way. And I think we have to figure out how to depoliticize the efforts that we have. And nothing short of that is really going to change where we're trying to go.
Thank you. We have a little bit of time. I think what I'd like to do is ask for two or three questions together and then have the panels answer them.
Yeah, we have microphones.
Okay, Jeff Zupan. And sorry, Dick, you can go next. And David.
Sorry for being an RPA staffer who's asking the first question, but I think I'm asking a question that many in the audience will have. How do you have change when you have in New York a division between the city and the state, between the mayor and the governor on one hand, and how do you have change in the region when you have the division between one state, New York, and another state, New Jersey, and all the powers that govern what we do are divided in those two ways?
Okay, while you're there, would you hand the mic to David? And then, right here.
Oh, sorry.
Related question. On the issue of taking the politics out of something, I think it's never going to happen in a political... everything is politics, and I want to point out... Arguably, London is highly politicized in the sense that there's a political officer, the mayor, who's clearly accountable, who puts a platform forth regarding transportation about what he or she is going to do. So it's a highly politicized system. but it aligns the political risks and rewards very clearly in the public's mind. And that's, I think, what's missing. Not taking politics out, but aligning the politics in a way that state government, and this is a national and international phenomenon, in Vancouver, British Columbia, they're concerned that the premier of British Columbia is more oriented toward Prince George or Nanaimo than to Vancouver. It's the same here that a state senator in Tonawanda has authority over Veronica's confirmation, whereas a city council member in Brooklyn does not. So my question is not, do we take politics out? It's how do you create a political system where the political elected officials are clearly accountable?
Interesting. Okay, behind you is Nicole.
Hi. Relatedly, we have a private sector that is heavily involved in a lot of our current corruption problems, whether it's private donors wanting a little bit of the governor's Buffalo revitalization project, or real estate developers giving to the mayor's groups to get affordable housing contracts. The private sector is a huge, huge part of this. And so how do we keep the private sector in transportation either becoming a perpetrator or a victim of this toxic corruption that we have at both the state and the city level? Thank you.
Okay, so let's take these three, and then we'll do one more round. Three very different questions. Are there any that any of you want to tackle either?
So I would start with Jeff's question, and I would say maybe we need to start mandating coordination. There are 24 metropolitan planning organizations throughout New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And they do not work well with the transit agencies. And not that there's animosity, but there's very little integration. In fact, even within the MTA service territory, there's very little coordination and integration between the city agencies and the MTA, even NJ Transit. There should be a mandate that they're working together, that they're coordinating their plans. A lot of these planning decisions and ideas are happening still in silos, but the territory overlaps so significantly. This is one of the most important regions in this country. And for decades, this decision-making and this planning has been happening in all these different regions and all these different counties. Maybe we need to start there.
But how do you mandate that? I mean, that's the question, mandating. But how, they are mandated to do that already.
One of the things that I think we, first of all, as you pointed out, Veronica, quite accurately, we cannot just limit ourselves to trying to figure out what we could get done under the current elected leadership.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
I mean, that's, you know, we take that for granted. It's one of the luxuries of the fourth regional plan. I think, you know, to all three questions, actually, though, it is this question of who's actually sovereign, right? How you provide the checks, balances, and transparency around the exercise of that sovereignty, right? And how you align it, David, as you so accurately said, how you focus responsibility. And so a couple of reactions. One is, yes, this region is divided up into three sovereign states under the Constitution, but of course, we also see a much greater sense of coordination at the mayoral level, right, at the local level, at the lived experience level. The reality is that I think the majority of people in this region understand that they are in a region, and kind of the math that Greg pointed out about, at the end of the day, if the UK is going to succeed, London has to succeed. It becomes a shared priority. And I think the mayors and others on the panel that I moderated this morning recognize that as well, that the mayor of Newark and the county executive of Suffolk County recognize that they are tied not only to New York City, but to each other. And the reality is that our governors and our state legislatures don't seem to reflect that, and so there is something that we are going to have to do at that municipality, mayoral, local level to get that message across. So I think that's part of it. I think, David, to your point, I don't know what the right answer is. I think it's going to be one of the things we have to figure out over the next year through the fourth plan. But, you know, clearly, if you look at the schools, and of course Mayor de Blasio was up in Albany recently making the case for mayoral control of the schools, the whole point was to do that. And what Mayor Bloomberg achieved, what Mayor Giuliani was denied, was to get rid of the nameless, faceless board of many smart people, but no doubt a bunch of cronies that did not have that accountability and replace it with the idea that you could hold one person accountable and have that person take their educational platform to the people for that mandate, right? And I think that's a very big component of this. And Nicole, I think to your point, you know, part of it, you know, there's no question that we also right now suffer from a great deal of corruption at the political level in this region, right? You know, you just have to, you know, I won't share my feelings about when the four elected leaders who killed congestion pricing, where they're going to be spending their next decade. In any case, but we have to start somewhere, number one. We cannot say that, well, just because our politics are broken, we have to let everything else be broken. And I think this kind of thing does help. Like, the more transparency, the more checks and balances, the more people to whom you are accountable. And, you know, it was Jay who first pointed this out to me a couple of years ago, you know, that we could each all buy a share of MTR stock on the New York Stock Exchange. And if the board of directors of MTR does something in violation of the rules of the Securities and Exchange Commission of the United States, we have the standing to hold them accountable in U.S. court.
Right.
That is a huge check in terms of how they make their decisions. And that is something that we do not have with any of our region's agencies currently.
Can I offer one other?
Sure.
And this is going to be a little bit of heresy, I guess, in the world of talking about regional
plans. That's what
we're
here for.
But frankly, I'm not sure regional governance models have any legs anymore. The fact of the matter is that technology has taken away a lot of the things that we actually argued we needed a regional governance model to do. Rit, I think, mentioned before that we have an example a little bit to the south of here in the D.C. area, where it certainly hasn't worked terribly well to be able to do that. And in fact, many of the things that frustrate us happen inside regional agencies. You know, the MTA still hasn't figured out how to get to a regional fare card, mm-hmm. notwithstanding the fact that it's all one agency. I can use a bank card from Citibank in Indonesia and take money out of a bank there, and it works because of technology. And why do we necessarily need to bundle everything to be able to find some of that? And I think, actually, commercial arrangements and technology are making a lot of that much, much easier for us to be able to do. I think we have to clarify what our objectives are and really seek to that. And it may be that the easiest way to answer some of the questions is not to strive to bring everything together into a bigger, bigger regional model, but to accept the fact that there are other ways to get there.
Not as operations, but what about in terms of coordination of planning goals and initiatives?
I think you can attack that in a number of different ways. So I wouldn't necessarily argue that you can only attack it one way, but I think once you begin to create large regional entities, I think you're going mm-hmm. to accrete a different responsibility to them, and I would worry about that a little mm-hmm. bit.
Okay.
There's two bits of experience from London that I think are relevant. And the first one is that when the Transport for London body that I described earlier was created, it had a very strict limit that it did nothing outside of its boundary. So it couldn't work in the 20 counties that sit around London. Not allowed, verboten, absolute line. The impact of all of that progress that I talked about and Jay illuminated is that now we've got this process of sort of negotiated voluntary association going on, so that these new regional lines or the old suburban lines, people are saying, oh, give it to TfL to manage. They know what to do. And so there is something about creating these integrations, these coordinations, through leadership and excellence rather than through political reforms and mandate. Show something that's good and people want to be part of it. And I would predict that Transport for London will be Transport for the greater southeast of England eventually, because everything will end up being given to the management teams that know what they're doing. That's more of a business kind of approach. So that's one thing. The other little thing I wanted to say is, obviously the key thing here is not that you don't want politicians anywhere near this, but you want politicians to do the things politicians are good at and not to do the things they're not good at. And in the model that we have, the politician appoints the board, agrees the plan, and is accountable for its performance. The politician doesn't make decisions about which bridge, which tunnel, which service, which operator. Yeah. So politicians should make those decisions, not those decisions. Yeah. You don't want your mayor driving the bus, do you?
I know we need to we need to wrap up, but Roger and Dick Anderson have both had their hands up this whole time. So,
Roger Herz, I recognize that turf is the single most strongest force in the universe. However, my understanding was there was a 6 or 12 trains that were running from New Haven to the Meadowlands a couple of years ago. I don't know if any of those still exist. There apparently is no mechanical problem in running through service. What are some of the specific actions that might be taken, because the potential here just seems to be remarkably unused?
Yeah.
New York Building Congress. This is a terrific discussion, but it calls the question is, where can we really expect the leadership? We have a different governmental system than we do in Great Britain, in France, in Japan, in China, much more of a unitary system. We've got 51 sovereign governments. So where, gentlemen, should we point the finger and say, you must be the leader out of this governance quandary?
That's a good question. Do we destroy all of the agencies we have now and create a new one, or do we empower one of the ones that we already have to take on new responsibilities? City Bike's doing great. Maybe we should just add on.
just by...
Wants to take the time.
I'll happily say something as the person in the room who knows nothing about the region. But I think we must differentiate between executive leadership and operational skill. And, you know, you want very, very high caliber operating teams under any structure to be in charge of the whole thing. But you must have executive accountability. I mean, obviously, your governance system is one of the most unhelpful of any of the big world city regions that we have, yeah? You have more coherent governance systems in London, Paris, Tokyo, Seoul, Hong Kong than you have in New York. You've got a problem. Okay, we know that. But the only person, it seems to me, that you could really try to build this around is the role of the mayor of New York. You have to really figure out how to develop that role so it has a regional dimension to it as well as the city's dimension.
That is a hot topic in itself, mayoral control.
There you go.
We actually have to wrap things up. But thank you very much to all the panelists.